Welcome to Newsweek on Air. I'm Associated Press correspondent Warren Levinson.
And I'm Newsweek contributing editor David Alpern. We have newsmakers and Newsweek correspondents to bring you these stories.
Solving the D.C. sniper case and what it's taught us about American law enforcement and public anxiety in these terror-sensitive times.
The Wellstone legacy and how his death may affect the balance of the Senate and the course of national policy.
The bloodbath in a Moscow theater. Russian troops rescue 700 hostages at the cost of more than 100 lives. Now Vladimir Putin faces the aftermath in Moscow and in Chechnya.
Filming Frida, David Anson on the new biopic about artist Frida Kahlo and the editor of a new book about making the movie.
Can consumers rescue the economy once again? Newsweek economics columnist Robert Samuelson on signs that shoppers are tired of the burden of prolonging prosperity.
Plus exclusives from Tipsheet and Periscope and notable quotes from the week's news.
All that and more when Newsweek on Air continues.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Do you have little ones around? Allergies driving you crazy? Can't sleep? Purify the air in your home with my Orrick Tabletop Air Purifier. Its lifetime filter never needs replacing. Try it free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Chances are you'll see the difference, feel the difference, and sleep better. And maybe you'll use a few less allergy pills.
You may have heard that just about anyone can handle your car's check engine light problem with a simple computer scan tool and a few parts. The fact is, only ASE-certified automotive technicians have the training, the equipment, and experience needed to actually find the problem and take care of it. You'll find ASE-certified technicians at quality repair shops in your area or at any one of over 11,000 NAPA Auto Care Centers nationwide. Call 1-800-LET-NAPA for a location near you. Remember, just getting it checked doesn't mean you're getting it fixed.
I catch murderers, rapists, and thieves. I do it by analyzing hair and fiber specimens. I guess you could say, chemistry class led me to a life of crime. I'm Julie Willey, director of the Delaware State Police Crime Lab. I have this very cool job today because when I was in high school, I didn't think it was uncool to take chemistry. My parents and teachers always encouraged me to study math and science. My older brother was my role model. He majored in biology, and so did I. Nobody ever expected less from me because I was a girl. Do you have a daughter? Instead of a tea set, get her a chemistry set. Tell her a girl can be any kind of scientist. An astronaut, a marine biologist, or even a forensic microscopist like me. Expect the best from a girl. That's what you'll get.
Help turn your daughter on to math and science. Call 1-800-WCC4GIRLS. This message brought to you by the Ad Council and the Women's College Coalition.
It's Newsweek on Air, the week of October 27th. I'm Warren Levinson of the Associated Press.
And I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
We now consider them suspects in the string of shootings in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia.
I admire Chief Moose very, very much. I think that he remained professional throughout the whole thing. The cooperation that he was able to gain speaks highly of his abilities, and I was somewhat comforted by the fact that he was leading this effort to catch these people.
I don't know, I think they did a good job. I mean, how they handled everything and how they were caught, I mean, pretty quickly, but I think they did a good job overall.
Yeah, it's a shame it had to take 3 weeks.
Montgomery County, Maryland Police Chief Charles Moose confirming the arrest of 41-year-old John Allen Muhammad and 17-year-old Lee Boyce Malvo in the sniper case that paralyzed much of Washington and its suburbs for weeks. Area residents are happy at the news, though, of course, some wonder if it couldn't have come sooner. While prosecutors wrangle over who will handle the case now and how best to assure the death penalty on conviction, postmortems have begun on the motives and the police work, in part to prepare for more organized and ideological terrorist attacks in the future.
For our postmortem on motives, methods, and the psychic fallout, we have Newsweek Assistant Managing Editor Evan Thomas in Washington, Hoover Institution Research Fellow Joseph McNamara, Ph.D., former police chief of San Jose, California, Newsweek columnist and novelist Anna Quindlen, and psychologist Patricia Farrell. But first, your views in the latest Newsweek poll. 44% are at least somewhat worried that someone in their family might fall victim to such a sniper, and by 48% to 44%, they expect similar attacks elsewhere in the country. 38% were more likely to support stricter gun control versus only 10% less likely, and 55% support a mandatory ballistic fingerprint database for newly sold weapons.
Evan Thomas, what do we know about motives in this case?
Well, you know, we still don't know much. If you watch movies, you would think either there must be terrorists or some devious psychotic, but it appears that the shooters were moved as much as anything by a child custody case. Now, that, of course, can be a serious thing, but you just don't find the profound motivation that you would look for in the case of somebody who's killed a dozen people.
But there was this conversion to Islam for John Mohammed, and there was a conversation overheard about him praising the 9/11 attacks. We don't think that this is really significant?
Well, he could be a sympathizer, and the feds are still looking at that angle. I don't want to close that off because that investigation is still going on. But so far, they have not found much, certainly any proof of an Al-Qaeda link or any kind of formal connection to terrorists. He may be a kind of self-recruited terrorist, but he doesn't talk in political or religious terms.
I gather some people he came in contact with told authorities about his rifle and some scary talk. What do we know about other tips missed? How well the authorities really conducted their investigation before the snipers themselves got through to priests and police and pointed them to a key fingerprint?
Well, it does appear that they were obsessed with this white truck or white car, kind of like Moby Dick, and there are, we have sources inside the investigation who are kind of shaking their heads over that say that it was chaotic on the inside, that they, you know, they, the snipers tried to call about a half a dozen times before anybody even took them seriously, that there was poor communication and coordination. It's, you know, it's hard when you have a massive manhunt with, I think, 16 jurisdictions, but there is a lot of noise on the inside that it didn't go that well.
Evan Thomas of Newsweek. Next up, former San Jose Police Chief Joe McNamara, now at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Chief McNamara, how do you rate the police work in this case?
Well, let's start with the positive. I think it was heroic in a lot of ways. The uniformed officers that stood out in schoolyards and shopping centers, knowing full well that there was a deadly sniper that might be drawing a bead on them, and yet they did their job to protect others. And I think probably the thousands of officers who really worked well in the case. The leadership, however, does leave some questions because they did not disclose, the pattern was not disclosing information constantly through the case that makes you wonder. For example, you have an explicit threat against children, and it's incomprehensible that any police officer would not warn parents of that danger so that people had information to decide whether to send their kids to school or let them play outdoors, and yet the police sat on that. Also, why in the world the suspect's identity and license plate number wasn't put out immediately when the police learned of it is another question, because that's how they were caught. The media was criticized by the police, but it was the media really who deserve a lot of credit, and the wonderful truck driver Ron Lanz, who not only made the 911 call reporting the car, but blocked the highway exit with his truck.
Well, what do you make of the fact that this car, in fact, was stopped twice before they actually made these arrests?
Well, that's another thing, that if the information had been put out as quickly as possible, it's quite possible the Baltimore police officer who first stopped the car might have held the person. He obviously was suspicious of John Mohammed sleeping in the car, and that might have saved some murders, and it might have saved a lot of terror in the area. So it seemed to me that it was the old police and federal law enforcement mythology of don't reveal information. It's a reflex that they have. And what they don't realize is that the news media is a great asset, but their biggest asset is the public. And
Chief,
giving information to the public, you can get the tips that eventually solve the crime.
Is this case a fair test of how U.S. Lawmen might deal with Al-Qaeda terrorists using sniper tactics? I mean, should we be looking at it through that perspective?
Well, I think it's exactly what will happen as the investigation goes on and as more facts come out. Law enforcement routinely goes through a critique of operations of this magnitude to see what they can learn. And one thing they will learn is that you have to recognize that you must give information to the public because the public has a right to know. But also, if you don't give the information, it actually impedes the solution of the crime. And in this case, it's a classic example. The Unabomber is another example. When the information was disclosed in his writings, it led his own brother to suspect him and to report him to authorities. So it seems a lesson that just has to be learned over and over again by some police leaders. But the rank and file cops, I think, did a magnificent job.
Former San Jose Chief Police, Chief of Police Joe McNamara. He's now at the Hoover Institution. Next up, Newsweek columnist Anna Quindlen. Anna, you say that essentially what we're doing is we're underlining the kind of fear that our children are being raised with. You know, I remember being raised with a fair amount of fear in the Cold War, and I'm sure you were, the drills about getting under the desk. How's this different?
Well, first of all, that Cold War fear never came to pass, luckily. There was never the day when suddenly we heard the words incoming and got under our desks for good. But the second thing is that it was this kind of faceless, far away threat. And I think what American kids have seen over the last year, and it's been an amazing year in terms of what they've been exposed to, all of them are threats from within.
In fact, you say by many standards, kids are safer today than before.
Well, there are all these things that we do to protect kids, everything from cabinet locks for toddlers to car seats to the notion that people will no longer be allowed to hit their kids with impunity and the kids will be believed when they say that they were sexually abused. But on the other hand, American kids went from what they saw on 9/11 to the anthrax scare, to the summer of the child kidnappings and some child murders, directly into this sniper situation in which some of them couldn't help but hear the warning, your children aren't safe anywhere, anytime.
Anna, hold the line while we...
growth industry.
Hold the line, Anna, while we take a break, and we'll be back to you. Back with Anna Quinlan and more on the sniper case.
You may have heard that just about anyone can handle your car's check engine light problem with a simple computer scan tool and a few parts. The fact is, only ASE-certified automotive technicians have the training, the equipment, and experience needed to actually find the problem and take care of it. You'll find ASE-certified technicians at quality repair shops in your area or at any one of over 11,000 NAPA Auto Care centers nationwide. Call 1-800-LET-NAPA for a location near you. Remember, just getting it checked doesn't mean you're getting it fixed.
Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, brought to you by Geico Auto Insurance.
Look how small Joe is. Isn't she petite?
Well, Beth is even littler than I.
Look how little Meg is. You can almost say she's tiny.
How is Geico able to offer 24-hour service and still save us money?
Perhaps it's because we are all so small.
We are small, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Round-the-clock service 7 days a week, and you could save 15% on car insurance. Call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. It's Halloween and... I bet that's the first trick-or-treater.
Trick-or-treat!
Hello, kids. Hey, you're a big cat.
It's me, Unc, your nephew Scruff.
A dog in a cat suit. I see you got a reflector on your stomach, cat.
Meow. That means yeah, so people can see me if it gets dark.
Good idea. What's that, Mr. Clown?
A flashlight, McGruff.
Good. Start out when it's light, but carry a flashlight just in case.
We're all going around together.
Ah, that's good, too. It's safer to travel in groups. And take a grown-up along with you.
Thanks, Unc. We gotta go to some other houses.
Yeah, well, make sure your parents have checked out those houses and know where you're going, kids.
So long, McGruff!
So long, and remember, wear costumes that can be seen, travel in groups with an adult, carry a flashlight, make sure your parents okay the houses, check your treats before you eat them, have a good time, and take a bite out of crime. A public service message from me, McGruff, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Crime Prevention Coalition, and the Ad Council.
We're back with Newsweek on Air. I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
I'm Warren Levinson of the Associated Press. We're back with Newsweek columnist Anna Quindlen, also a novelist, of course, talking about the psychic fallout of the sniper case. Anna, I think it's really curious. We talk about how kids are safer now than they ever have been. But I would argue that, in fact, some of the things or a lot of the things that we do to keep our kids safe, put them in child safety seats, have the cabinet latches and the window guards, it helps create a sort of underlying climate of fear that sort of, you know, there are dangers out there everywhere in ways that you and I did not think about when we were kids.
Well, there is some truth to that. There's no doubt about it. But I think most of those are sort of micro attempts to keep kids safe, unless, you know, you're looking at things like school warnings about child abuse or about sexual abuse. But it also creates this false sense in the minds of parents that somehow the bad stuff can't get in. And I think what we saw this year, and certainly this month, is that's really an illusion of safety.
Newsweek columnist and novelist Anna Quindlen. Finally, to psychologist and crime consultant Patricia Farrell, actually crime-fighting consultant, we should say, author of How to Be Your Own Therapist. Dr. Farrell, how much of the anxiety generated by a case like this will linger long after the men have been taken off the street?
Well, you know, I think that's a very important point, because what we're looking at these days is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think that kids certainly can suffer from this disorder, as can adults, and that disorder does not manifest itself quickly. It's going to take possibly months before we know the full effect on the population at large. So that stuff is going to be lingering out there, and I would say to parents or guardians or whatever, just watch and be aware that there are going to be changes. It doesn't mean that your child is going to have a long-standing psychiatric illness, but there's going to be some changes, and I would say probably in the next 3 months, that three-month period right after this is going to be the most difficult for everyone. So
Kind of changes should we be looking for?
Well, I think you'll find things like kids aren't as willing to go to school. Now, we know kids aren't willing to go to school most times anyway, but they're going to have a little bit more difficulty. They're going to be a little more concerned about separating from the parent or the guardian. They're going to want to know, are they safe in school? There may be increased irritability. There may be some backsliding in terms of bedwetting, things like that, nightmares, wanting lights left on in the home. So all of these things may tax your ability to be understanding, but you're going to need to be a little more understanding now.
In general, given the way the media covered this, and we'll continue to cover things like it, is it better for parents to shield kids as much as they can or talk about the evil dangers in the world?
Well, I think you have to talk about them. I think if you try to shield them, then you create a climate of secrecy, and that increases fear. You know, the worst fears are the ones that we don't know very much about. If you face your fear, if you talk about it, you can take away some of that pain, anxiety, whatever. So I would say be prudent in what you supply to your child in terms of knowledge, but don't think that you can shield them totally, because they have to go out into the world one day. So begin now to help them understand that there are some bad people in the world, but there are some very, very good people in the world too.
Do you admit to fears yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When this fellow was going around, I was saying, well, good thing I don't have to go to the D.C. area, because I don't know if I would go.
Psychologist Patricia Farrell is author of How to Be Your Own Therapist. We also spoke with Assistant Managing Editor Evan Thomas and Anna Quindlen and former Police Chief Joe McNamara of the Hoover Institution.
He was coming to the people of Minnesota that he loved, and he wanted their support so he could go and return to the United States Senate and fight for them. We'll miss you, Paul, and we'll never forget you.
Senator Edward Kennedy had come to Minnesota to help Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone in a close re-election campaign, but he ended the day delivering a eulogy for the Senate's most liberal member, killed with his wife, daughter, and several aides in the crash of a small plane headed for a friend's funeral.
Beyond the human tragedy, Wellstone's death throws the campaign into a political twilight zone that extends to the Senate itself, where the Democrats' one-vote margin is suddenly eliminated, though with no immediate effect because we're in recess. Independent Governor Jesse Ventura has the right to name a replacement for the remaining month of Wellstone's term, but he's only promised not to name himself. The state's Democratic Party has a right to name a new nominee, with a lot of speculation focused now on former Vice President Walter Mondale.
For some thoughts on Wellstone and the fallout from his death, we have Brookings Institution scholar Tom Mann, but first an update on the midterm elections nationwide from the latest Newsweek poll. Republicans have an insignificant 46-43% lead among likely voters. Democrats an even slimmer 43-41% edge among all registered voters, suggesting that turnout could be key. Only 23% say the Iraq attack issue is most important to their midterm vote, versus 29% who cite social issues, another 29% citing proposals to help the economy, 10% local issues. To the degree Iraq is an issue, by 50-37%, those surveyed said it would be better to delay any attack to get more support from our allies. President Bush's job approval is steady at 61%, but still down from 83% at the beginning of the year.
Now to Tom Mann at the Brookings Institution. The talk about Wellstone's legacy is that he was the most liberal member of the Senate, but respected across the political spectrum. What do you remember about him?
That's right. When he first came to the Senate, he was young and brash, didn't fit in very well, was inclined to demonize his political adversaries. But over time, Paul Wellstone grew to have enormous regard and respect for the institution of the Senate, ended up building partnerships with some unusual senators, including Jesse Helms, Pete Domenici, Sam Brownback on the Republican side of the aisle. Listen, Paul Wellstone was a man of strong political convictions. He was a man who loved local politics and organizing. He loved to embrace people in his home state of Minnesota, but he was also a sort of gentle and respectful man. That's how I think of him.
Could Wellstone's absence or a non-Democratic replacement named by Ventura have a significant effect on Senate operations policy in the time that remains in this session?
No, I don't really believe so. I mean, the shock and tragedy of Wellstone's death seemed to me to preclude any partisan effort to pass a whole lot of things that wouldn't have otherwise passed if Wellstone remained alive. In any case, Democrats in the Senate would have the capacity to filibuster any such effort. So I don't expect much coming from that.
In the half minute we have left, what about the shock affecting the campaign, regardless of whether it's Mondale or whoever's chosen to replace him?
I think Wellstone was likely to win that race. It was close, but he had really come out on top, especially after his vote against authorizing military force in Iraq. I think the Democrats will need to nominate a visible and respected figure. Vice President Walter Mondale fits that. I think he would win easily if he is chosen and agrees to run.
Tom Mann is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Here's a quote from the news. A year after 9/11, America remains dangerously unprepared to prevent and respond to a catastrophic terrorist attack on U.S. soil. The conclusion of another panel of national security experts urging more spending to protect vulnerable areas such as ports, power plants, food supplies, and to increase information about terrorist activity to local police.
And in fact, this was the same panel that made recommendations a couple of years before 9/11. Next up, the hostage crisis in Moscow.
You may have heard that just about anyone can handle your car's check engine light problem with a simple computer scan tool and a few parts. The fact is, only ASE-certified automotive technicians have the training, the equipment, and experience needed to actually find the problem and take care of it. You'll find ASE-certified technicians at quality repair shops in your area or at any one of over 11,000 NAPA Auto Care centers nationwide. Call 1-800-LET-NAPA for a location near you. Remember, just getting it checked doesn't mean you're getting it fixed.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. According to the EPA, fresh air is becoming increasingly hard to find, especially in our homes. That's why I want you to try my Orrick Tabletop Air Purifier free for 30 days. It uses the same advanced technology as a U.S. submarine fleet, and it'll clean the air in your home faster than you can say Gesundheit. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200.
Cindy here for the Environmental Defense Fund at the supermarket with some smart shoppers. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what's for dinner?
Pudding!
Excellent. What kind?
Vanilla. Chocolate. Lemon mousse.
Oh, how sophisticated.
Why, thank you.
Okay, shoppers, when shopping for pudding, what's the most important thing to look for on the label?
100% pudding!
Besides that.
Package made from recycled material.
Bingo. All sorts of products and packaging are now being made from the paper, plastic, metal, and glass that you recycle. But to keep recycling working, you have to buy those products. So when you pick up a package, read the label.
Just make sure it's pudding.
It's for all kinds of products.
As long as they're pudding.
This is Cindy saying for a free brochure on buying recycled, call 1-800-CALL-EDF.
Or 1-800-PUDDING. Come on.
Oh, all right. 1-800-CALL-EDF.
This message from the Ad Council, the U.S. EPA, and the Environmental Defense Fund.
You're listening to Newsweek on Air. I'm Warren Levinson of the Associated Press.
And I'm David Alpern of Newsweek. The hostage crisis in Moscow ended at dawn Saturday with explosions, gunfire, and the wailing of ambulance sirens as Russian special forces stormed a theater where Chechen militants had just killed two of more than 700 hostages they had threatened to execute if President Vladimir Putin did not immediately end Russian military operations in Chechnya. First reports had most of the rebels killed or captured, scores of hostages dead.
That so many were saved is a triumph for Putin, but the incident itself is dramatic evidence that he has not ended Russia's problem in Chechnya, nor been able to keep it from the very heart of Moscow. For more on the crisis and its implications for Putin, for his policies and connections to Washington's war on terrorism, we have Newsweek Moscow Bureau Chief Christian Karl and Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group.
First, to Christian. At first, the question was, were these hostages killed by the Chechens before the assault or by the Russian special forces? But you're saying it was actually anesthetic gas pumped into the theater that may have been most responsible.
Yes, well, I mean, to be very technical about it, I don't think it was an anesthetic gas. It was what the chemical warfare people call an incapacitating gas.
Uh-huh.
And both Russia and the United States produced enormous quantities of these gases during the Cold War. And basically the idea is that you spray it over the front lines of your enemy, and it then impairs the enemy soldiers' abilities to make decisions. And sometimes the idea was that they even just get happy and they put their guns down and they walk away, and then you take over their positions. And in this particular case, the Russian special forces, who staged the assault on the theater, apparently pumped this gas into the building very, very slowly and quietly. And the thing about this gas is that you begin to be affected by it without realizing that it's happening. And they seem to have miscalculated a bit how much of this gas they could pump into this closed space. And as a result, there are hundreds of people who are suffering from symptoms of poisoning, basically, poisoning by gas. And there is the suspicion, at least in Moscow, although everyone is still dancing around it a bit, that, in fact, some of the now 90 dead we're hearing, now we're hearing a total of 90 dead in the operation among the hostages, there's the suspicion that some of those dead might actually have died from inhaling too much of this gas.
What's the immediate public reaction to how Putin handled this?
Well, I think Putin still gets very good marks. He is, of course, the ultimate Teflon leader. Even after the Kursk, when there were things you could criticize him about, it never really hurt his reputation, especially badly. In this case, I think he's actually earned very good marks because his conduct throughout the whole crisis has been very, very, well, typical of Putin, very, very calm, very, very low-key, very determined. Tonight he held a speech, and he came out with an address to the nation in which he said, this event has once again shown that Russia will never be forced to its knees.
And what about and the what about the arrest
that
of
kind of resoluteness about him that people like?
What about the arrests of other Chechen supporters around Moscow? What about the presence of Arabs within this Chechen group?
Well, that, I think, is a rather controversial thing. There do seem to have been some Arabs in the group, but it's a little hard to judge because, you know, you get a senior Moscow politician going into the building not very long after it was liberated and saying, I saw an Arab and an Afghan. And, of course, you have to ask yourself, you know, what kind of ethnological knowledge this Moscow city official really has. You know, there are two corpses lying there, and one of them looks like an Afghan, one of them looks like an Arab, and it's, you know, one has to be a little careful about these things. But apparently some of the hostage takers did speak Arabic, in fact, and were making phone calls to various places, and we're told, at least, in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and various other spots. So, you know, there must be something there, but one has to be a little careful about about the evidence, basically.
Newsweek Bureau Chief Christian Karl in Moscow. Next up, Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group, a think tank focused on Russia and the former Soviet Empire. So how does this affect Moscow's operations in Chechnya?
Well, I think that President Putin has said many times that there's going to be resoluteness from Russia on the Chechen issue. It's an internal question. There's not going to be a lot of give and take, and there's not going to be any questions around the possibility of Chechen independence. I think there was no question that he wasn't going to negotiate very far with the captors when this crisis began. I think what will happen is, as we see parliamentary elections coming up in a year, is that the Russian left may well start to coalesce around the Chechen issue. And long term, we could see that this incident was one that could beginning to chink away at Putin's armor. He came to power on a landslide, relatively unknown, primarily on his strength on Chechnya. A few months later, said that the Russians had won the war. He gets high marks for the way he resolved this issue, but low marks increasingly from the Russian public from the way he's handled the war. And I do think that you're going to see more problems for him internally as the months pass.
You've said you think this could be a significant factor in U.S.-Russian relations if Putin wants President Bush to add the Chechens to his list of terrorists.
Well, one thing that this clearly does for the world media as well as for the United States is it places the Chechen conflict within the context of the greater war on terror. We've had Indonesia, Bali, we've now just had Moscow. These are incidents that are roundly condemned around the world, and certainly if it is found, as it appears likely, that there was coordination of Arab militants together with the Chechens, that's going to draw further links. I think you could easily see the Bush administration in the coming weeks to months making stronger statements about Russian-U.S. cooperation and linking Chechnya, and perhaps even naming Chechen organizations along with the official list of terrorist organizations. That would obviously, sort of interestingly, serve to further coordinate the United States-Russian relations on the war on terror.
Ian Bremmer heads the Eurasia Group think tank in New York. We also spoke with Newsweek Moscow Bureau Chief Christian Karl. Something in the Periscope, David?
A simple bulge in an ancient wall of Jerusalem's old city has some Israelis fretting about Armageddon. It's not just any wall. The rocks help support an enormous stone platform that holds Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, among Islam's most sacred shrines. When thousands of worshippers flock to the area at the start of the holy month of Ramadan next week, the extra weight could cause the wall to collapse, says prize-winning archaeologist Gabriel Barkay. Parts of the compound can then tumble down with it. Barkay fears fall short of Armageddon, but only just. He imagines many dead worshippers and perhaps riots around the Middle East. All you need is a big group to congregate up there for the equilibrium to start shifting, he says. It's a matter of time.
I want to thank Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey. He wrote, "Dear Mr. Oreck, I just had to drop you a note regarding your wonderful product. We have a large house and a big dog that sheds year-round. Since the day we got our 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum cleaner, my wife has been in heaven. She loves its efficiency, lightweight, and actually enjoys vacuuming since it takes less time, it's less exhausting, and picks up pet hair in one sweep. Recently, my wife panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The vacuum is as good as new. Your company's sense of customer service is excellent. We're an Oreck family for life. My friends, I'll send you my 8-pound Oreck XL to use risk-free for 30 days. Call me at 1-800-989-4200. That's 1-800-989-4200.
10,000 eyes are on me, shouting, "Casey, go all the way. First base, second base, third base. Make your move today. Do it, Casey, do it. Score mighty, Casey, score." I just don't get it. Is that what girls are for?
If you don't talk with your kids about sex, who will? Call 1-800-CHILD-44. For a free booklet that can help you discuss sex, AIDS, and other tough issues.
Must I, Amanda, take this guy to heaven to hold, to go out with and make out with, to go all the way, because they say he'll walk away, unless I do.
Talk with your children early. Call 1-800-CHILD-44. Sponsored by the Kaiser Family Foundation, Children Now, and the Ad Council.
We have more Newsweek on air for you. I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
I'm Warren Levinson of the Associated Press.
Burn this house. Burn
music from the soundtrack of Frida, a new big screen biography produced and by and starring Salma Hayek as the great Mexican artist Frida Kahlo, also known for her life of passion and pain, for twice marrying Diego Rivera, her fellow artist and fellow womanizer. David Anson has seen the film. He's here with a review. Also with us is Linda Sunshine, editor of a new book about the production, Frida, bringing Frida Kahlo's life to life and art to film, from Newmarket Press. It contains the complete shooting script, production notes, pictures from the set, and Kahlo's real life. Linda Sunshine, what made actress Salma Hayek so passionate about producing and starring in this project?
I think this was a project that she had had in her mind for the for at least 10 years. I mean, it's a brilliant part for an actress. It's got passion and color, and Frida Kahlo was absolutely an amazing woman, and Selma's great in the part.
And how did the finished film strike the biographer on whose work this is based?
Well, Hayden Herrera, who wrote the biography on which it's based, absolutely loved it. She wrote an introduction for the book, in fact, and talks about how Julie Taymor, as an artist, a director-artist, made a piece of art out of Frida Kahlo's life. It's not like reading a biography. It's like being inside the head of an artist, which was the real challenge in making the movie.
And what do you find the most interesting backstage stories in this book about how the project finally came together?
Well, there have been so many people who have tried to bring Frida Kahlo's life to screen, and it's been such a long journey. So many actresses have tried to make this happen, and Selma talks about the 10 years that she spent bringing this to film. I mean, they had so many challenges in terms of, Julie didn't want to make a movie that was just a biography, a straight, you know, kind of made for TV kind of biography, and what she does in the movie is brings you into the art. The art actually comes alive during the course of the movie, and I think it's an amazing portrait of being inside a painter's head.
Why was it so hard to get this done?
Well, it's always complicated when you're dealing with the estate of Frida Kahlo or Diego Rivera. They're considered national treasures of Mexico. And Mexicans are very, very proprietary about them. It's very hard to get rights to their story. It's very hard to get rights to using the art. It's a huge challenge just to bring that to the screen. Plus, you know, it's a story about two people who, they're no angels. I mean, they're both, as you say, both incredible womanizers, and their politics were quite radical at the time, and it's not a traditional love story by any means.
Linda Sunshine is editor of the movie tie-in book Frida, bringing Frida Kahlo's life and art to film. Filming an artist's life is a risky business, says Newsweek's movie critic David Anson. And despite flashes of color, he says that Julie Taymor's movie falls back too often on what he calls biopic cliches.
This is a movie that many people have been trying to get made for years and years. Madonna wanted to make it, and Jennifer Lopez wanted to produce it, and Selma Hayek won out. But it looks like it's got a team of writers, four accredited, six apparently worked on it, and it feels a bit jerry-built. So it's built around her complex love affair with the artist Diego Rivera, who she married twice. And there's not a tremendous amount of chemistry between Hayek and Alfred Molina, who plays Rivera. And though the film has these great sort of Julie Taymor flourishes, it feels surprisingly conventional. And Hayek, though she gives it, she looks remarkably like Frida. She's got the famous uni eyebrow. She gives it the good college try, but she really doesn't have the depth to give us this woman's soul. Frida was a woman who lived in sort of constant pain from the results of a horrible accident she'd been in when she was young. And Hayek is just kind of too young and fresh to convey that struggle with pain. She feels a little bit lightweight in the part.
Well, Taymor, as you say, does, though, depart from this sort of standard let's tell the facts and goes into a certain amount of magic realism, which, if anybody saw The Lion King, would be pretty much her stock in trade.
Yes, she does, but it almost feels, it's like window dressing. It doesn't feel terribly integral. It's like all of a sudden there will be a fantasy dream sequence here, or to show her trip to New York with Rivera, partly to overcome the limited budget she had. It's done as a kind of collage, an art collage with the characters walking through Russian constructivist images of New York. But it feels sort of tacked on. It doesn't feel terribly organic in this case. I think she's a wonderful theater director, but I don't know if she's a natural-born filmmaker.
We also have an all-star cast here of the various characters, real-life characters, who populated Kahlo and Rivera's life. We have, Jeffrey Rush in here. We have Ashley Judd. How do all they come off?
Well, Jeffrey Rush, unfortunately, does not come off well at all. He's a very good actor, but he's horribly miscast as Leon Trotsky, who was one of her lovers. And I have to confess it, when he appeared with one of the worst Russian accents I've heard, makes Harrison Ford's and the submarine movie look good.
Yikes.
I started to giggle a bit. I mean, it almost felt like a Saturday Night Live skit.
So overall, they didn't quite get it.
They didn't quite get it. It's too bad because, you know, people were eagerly awaiting this movie. And it's obviously, you know, the shame is it's obviously a labor of love for Hayek. And Taymor obviously, you know, identifies strongly with Frida as a fellow artist. But somehow it doesn't quite catch fire.
Newsweek film critic David Anson. We also talked with Linda Sunshine, editor of the movie tie-in book, Frida, Bringing Frida Kahlo's Life and Art to Film.
Here's a quote from the news. An administrator and judge of unblemished integrity, but there is nothing in his background to show that he will be an instrument of change or that he has any recent experience in these areas. That was Duke University securities law expert James D. Cox on the naming of former FBI and CIA chief William Webster as the head of a new accounting oversight board. The decision was made by three Republicans of the five-member Securities and Exchange Commission. The two Democrats on the commission plan to formally dissent.
Here's another. The real question is, where do we go from here? That was Dr. Janet Woodcock, who directs the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, on the decision to scrutinize more hormone replacement therapy, since finding that postmenopausal women taking a form called Prempro for even a brief period had higher than average numbers of heart attacks, strokes, blood clots, and breast cancer.
And one more. I am more excited than ever about Carl's prospects. That was Democratic National Committee Chairman Terry McAuliffe reversing an earlier threat to cut funding to Carl McCall, the party's underdog candidate for governor of New York. Earlier, McAuliffe had been quoted as saying that he was only going to spend money on races the Democrats could win. Still ahead, can consumers continue to carry the economy?
Did you know that vitamin C does much more than support your immune system? Friends, it's Larry King with remarkable news. Scientists have developed a revolutionary vitamin C called Ester-C. Ester-C's the future of C. It's a unique, patented, non-acidic vitamin C. I take Ester-C every day. It supports my immune system and helps promote the health of my eyes, joints, and cardiovascular system. Ester-C at GNC. And everywhere vitamins are sold. Ester-C. Don't settle for less. Your body will know the difference.
You may have heard that just about anyone can handle your car's check engine light problem with a simple computer scan tool and a few parts. The fact is, only ASE-certified automotive technicians have the training, the equipment, and experience needed to actually find the problem and take care of it. You'll find ASE-certified technicians at quality repair shops in your area or at any one of over 11,000 Napa Auto Care centers nationwide. Call 1-800-LET-NAPA for a location near you. Remember, just getting it checked doesn't mean you're getting it fixed.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. It's Halloween and... I bet that's the first trick-or-treater.
Trick-or-treat!
Hello, kids. Hey, you're a big cat.
It's me, Unc, your nephew Scruff.
A dog in a cat suit. I see you got a reflector on your stomach, cat.
Meow. That means yeah, so people can see me if it gets dark.
Good idea. What's that, Mr. Clown?
A flashlight, McGruff.
Good. Start out when it's light, but carry a flashlight just in case.
We're all going around together.
Ah, that's good, too. It's safer to travel in groups. And take a grown-up along with you.
Thanks, Unc. We gotta go to some other houses.
Yeah, well, make sure your parents have checked out those houses and know where you're going, kids.
So long, McGruff!
So long, and remember, wear costumes that can be seen, travel in groups with an adult, carry a flashlight, make sure your parents okay the houses, check your treats before you eat them, have a good time, and take a bite out of crime. A public service message from me, McGruff, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Crime Prevention Coalition, and the Ad Council.
Once more, it's Newsweek on Air. I'm Warren Levinson of the Associated Press.
I'm David Alpern of Newsweek with this week's tip sheet. A good reason to stop procrastinating about your flu shot. It might help ward off heart attack or stroke. In one new study, French researchers found that 90 people hospitalized for stroke were less likely than a control group to have gotten flu shots. An Argentinian team tracked 301 men and women who had survived a heart attack or undergone an artery opening procedure. Half were vaccinated, half weren't. 6 months later, 98% of those receiving the shot were still alive, compared with 92% of those who didn't get it. Why? Heart attacks are more common in the winter than in the summer. Growing evidence suggests that the infections that cause flu and pneumonia may be to blame. Infections can raise blood pressure, cancer, increase the number of white blood cells, and push cholesterol levels in unhealthy directions, among other consequences.
The market clearly has overlooked that, and I don't know why. It's a terrible report on the consumer. We have consumer sentiment. We have consumer current conditions. And we have their appraisal, their expectations of the future, all falling to new cycle lows.
Economist Robert Bruska on the gloomy assessment of the consumer mood measured in the monthly University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey.
American consumers are the heroes of the world economy, writes our economics columnist Robert Samuelson. We have continued to buy through recession, through talk of war, and through a cratering stock market.
But there are signs we're about to put our wallets away at last, which could push the economy back to recession. So, Bob Samuelson, consumer spending is the key to the direction of the economy?
In some ways, that's always true, because consumer spending represents about two-thirds of the economy, GDP. It's actually up to 69% now. If you add in housing, you're almost up to three-quarters. So if the consumer sector is in very bad shape, the economy, by definition, is in bad shape. But it's particularly true now because every other part of the economy is very weak. Exports are weak because foreign economies are weak. Business investment has been declining for seven consecutive quarters because there's a lot of excess capacity. There's a little strength in federal spending, but to some extent it's offset by weakness in state and local government spending. So the consumer sector, broadly defined to include home building, is really the last bastion against economic setback.
And what is the evidence that the consumer sector is going the way that those other sectors you just mentioned are going?
Well, there is some suggestive evidence. First, retail sales have been weakening. They're still growing, but they're growing at a lower rate than they used to be. Second, consumer confidence has fallen rather precipitously. It's declined, at least in the confidence indicators, for five consecutive months, and by some measures are really lower than they've been since the early 1990s. And finally, we seem to be getting at least a slowdown in some consumer borrowing. So those are all real big negatives.
We have delinquencies up in terms of paying off of loans?
Yeah, consumer debt levels are fairly high. And on a total basis, consumers are now paying about 14% of disposable income for both principal and interest every month. And that's only slightly below the record of 14.4. And you are seeing some increase in bad debts, which means that lenders are going to be a little bit more leery about lending, and they're going to tighten up on some of their lending standards.
Is there evidence of how the stock market has affected consumer behavior?
Well, you know, I think we don't know as much about this as we think we know. I mean, the idea is that if the market goes up, people tend to spend a little bit more freely because they think they have saved more, because their portfolios are worth more. And as the market goes down, you get a reverse effect. In other words, people look at their shrunken portfolios, feel themselves to be poorer, which they are, and save a little bit more and spend a little bit less. But the mechanical relationship between the two is probably not as precise as we thought. But the fact that the market's lost over 20% this year and has lost more than 40% since the peak in March 2000 cannot be good for consumer spending.
Still, there are analysts who say that consumer spending will once again ride in to rescue this economy. What's the evidence of that?
I think that people are the optimistic analysts, and I hope they're right, and they may be right, don't believe that we're going to get a kind of burst of consumer spending, but they do believe that it will remain strong enough to carry the economy until you get business investment kicking back in. And I think they're optimism basically reflects a couple of things. One is that there's been an awful lot of refinancing of mortgages at lower interest rates, which means that the homeowners are either cutting their monthly payments, which leaves more for something else, or they're doing a so-called cash out, which means that they're borrowing a little bit more based on the increased home values, and they're probably spending that. And there's still a fair amount of mortgage refinancings in the pipe, so to speak. I think another reason for optimism is that Americans just like to buy things, and it takes a lot to discourage them. And, you know, finally, there's a theory that some of the data may be a little bit skewed because people's behavior has changed, that Americans have become very price conscious, and they kind of delay their spending until very close to holidays, Halloween or Christmas or whatever, to make sure that they're getting the biggest price discounts. So you get a little bit more variability in the statistics, because in one month it may appear a little bit weak, but in the next month it may be a little bit stronger. So that's the hopeful scenario.
Bad for retailers, good for production.
It's bad for retailers in the sense that their prices get knocked down and their profits get knocked down, but somebody's still got to produce these things, and that's good for employment and production, right?
Of course, into this you could throw war with Iraq, and that could change everybody's perception.
There are an awful lot of imponderables here. There's a possibility of a war with Iraq, which might spike oil prices. There's a possibility that the Federal Reserve will again cut interest rates. There's a possibility that that Congress and the President will decide that the economy is a little bit weaker than they'd like and will come in with some sort of a stimulus package. So there's an unusual amount of uncertainty piled on top of an unusual amount of uncertainty.
Robert Samuelson is economics columnist at Newsweek.
Here's another quote from the news. My reaction is, it's possible, but I hesitate to say probable. I don't see how anybody can say more. That was Dr. Joseph Fitzmyer, professor emeritus of New Testament Studies at Catholic University in Washington, on the discovery of a 2,000-year-old ossuary stone some see as palpable proof of a historical Jesus. Found in or near Jerusalem, it was inscribed, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus.
Next, the mail call.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. I appreciate the love letters I get about my amazing 8-pound Orrick XL vacuum cleaner. Here's one from Antioch, California. It goes, Dear Mr. Orrick, as a mother of two, I was in search of a miracle vacuum, and I'm so happy I found one in Orrick. I have a baby on the floor, a long-haired Sheltie, and two dachshunds, plus a 7-year-old son who's tracking in all kinds of dirt. My Orrick XL cleans everything up and goes easily from my carpet to my tile floors. I used to settle for OK clean. Now I have total clean beneath my feet. Sincerely, Stacy Davies. Friends, if you have dogs or cats or kids, insist on total clean, not just OK clean. Try my miracle vacuum, the powerful 8-pound Orrick XL, risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200. Maybe one day I'll invent a vacuum that can put away toys. Now that would really be a miracle.
Time for one more quote from the news before we go. I am here for one reason and one reason alone, to send a message against mudslinging. That was Mike Taylor, who has reconsidered his withdrawal from the Montana Senate race because of an advertisement that he said implied he was gay.
What have you got to say? What station do you hear us on? What time? Write to me, David Alpern, at Newsweek on Air, 251 West 57th Street, New York, New York, 10019. Or you can email to letters@newsweek.com.
The program was produced by Hope Glassberg and Ali Nicholas, engineered by Lance Neal.
I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
And I'm AP correspondent Warren Levinson. Newsweek on Air is a copyrighted co-production of Newsweek magazine and the Associated Press.
Big Brothers Big Sisters is looking for volunteers to be a guiding light for today's youth and help shape their future. Are you qualified to become a Big Brother or Big Sister? Let's find out.
Can you burp the alphabet?
Do you have an imaginary friend?
Have you ever started a pillow fight?
Do you know what a noogie is?
Have you ever laughed so hard soda shot out of your nose?
Have you ever given someone a wedgie?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you may have what it takes to be a Big Brother or Big Sister. Because if you think being a big means you have to act like a saint, think again.
Have you ever put a frog in someone's lunchbox?
Tied someone's shoelaces together?
Held your breath until you turned purple?
Shot a spitball?
Gotten cooties?
Jumped up and down in your bed?
Eaten anything for money?
Call 1-888-412-BIGS or visit BigBrothersBigSisters.org to learn how volunteering just a few hours a week can make a difference in the life of a child and make you feel like a kid again. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Of uncertainty. Come in with some sort of a stimulus package.